Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place.
Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitars. And today I have a great interview. I've got a sort of secret weapon out of Nashville, John Capito. He is... all the insiders in the know go to John to take care of their tone and their sound and their amplifiers. John currently runs two businesses. His company, Magnetic Flux Music, handles all the amp modifications and any kind of amp wizardry needed for an elite group of Nashville guitarist insiders, including some of the top session guys in town and a number of well-known A-list celebrities. John won't admit to this, but I've had clients tell me that he's literally a genius when it comes to sound and tone. And his other company, Black Tape Amplifiers, he builds some of the most robust amps out there, and I expect many more people know about John and about Black Tape Amplifiers in the next 12 months. John's got a great personality. He's a deep guy right up my alley, and he's got a lot to say, and I've really been looking forward to this interview since we first met and spoke about a week ago. John, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Craig, thank you for your kind words. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Just the truth. So I want to talk about both your businesses, but let's get to know you a little bit first. Where are you originally from, and where'd you grow up?
I spent most of my life in Tennessee, Craig, although usually I lived in East Tennessee. But I've lived in Nashville for about 9 years, and I think I'm a Southerner. I did spend some time in New England, a little bit of time in California. I've got to taste some of the other American cultures.
Cool.
I'm a Tennessean.
I have never lived in California. I've only passed through an airport, a business trip or two. What's it like? What is it like to live there? Because I'm, a stereotypical New Yorker in some ways. I'm not rude or abrasive at all, but I'm very direct. And
right.
I always found California very hard to adjust to. Being from the East Coast like that, what did you find the big difference between California and, let's say, Tennessee, which is an amazing place, one of the nicest, if not the nicest group of people I've ever met anywhere I've traveled?
Well, I spent 3 years in California. It was in Northern California, which is a different experience than Southern. Hmm. And it's what I've learned about being an outsider moving to California, I've only learned since I left. Now that I live in Nashville, Nashville is a real popular city. We have all of these people moving here. I think they say 78 people a day are moving to Nashville right now. And as I see people from California or New York move here, and the way they act and the way they try to fit in with what they think it means to be a Tennessean, I've learned, I think, some things about myself when I was a Tennessean trying to be a Californian.
Oh,
if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense. Go ahead. So what did you learn? What were the differences?
Well, a lot of the people who are from California for a generation or more will tell you it's the people who aren't from there who are the ones who act the most stereotypically Californian. And so looking back at my time there, I think that I was definitely like that. You know, here's the Southern guy who's trying to learn yoga and maybe learns a little bit more about liberalism and being open-minded, whereas I'm not sure. I think that people from there are just people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely I will say with respect to Northern California, there was something that when you think of Johnny Cash saying a country boy will survive from Southern Alabama to Northern California, I'd never really thought about that, and that is true. Although California is California, the rural parts of Northern California, there is something definitely in common with the South as far as people being courteous and friendly and maybe a notch calmer.
Yes.
So I would say that is definitely an interesting aspect to it.
Yeah, that's a good point, because Florida is the same way. All the people that are from other places that are moving here, they're the real nutty ones that you read about. And but the most of the time, the regular Florida crackers, they call them, but they're totally mellow sort of country, very exactly what you said, polite, courteous, you know, all the things you said. So that's very interesting. Yeah. What kind of childhood did you have?
I had a good one. I don't know that there's much really interesting to share there, but I've got a younger sister. We grew up in a rural part of East Tennessee. My dad was a banker. My mom was an interior designer, and went to school, had a pretty good time. Nothing really exciting to share there. Interestingly, I did not play guitar in my youth. I actually did not start playing the guitar until the late teenage years. And I think that the more musicians I'm around, I think that there are some people who, I think that if you're going to be a musician, starting as early in life as possible is important, because there are certain skills that you develop when you're young and your brain is open-minded, and unless you have a real strong aptitude, I definitely think it's a good idea to expose your children to music as early as possible, because I definitely see that as one thing I would change about my childhood, is I wish that I could have had more opportunity to play music and participate and learn those types of skills. Because for me, music is rocket science. It's very difficult. I love it, obviously. I love it tremendously. But what would take me a couple hours to learn, I see some of the musicians here in Nashville, you know, can pick it up in 20 minutes or maybe even 2 minutes. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, that's interesting. What got you into, you started in late teens, what prompted that? So if you didn't grow up in a musical household, it's interesting that you even started playing. What? How did that come about?
Well, we had a lot of music in my house. You know, my father had literally every single Motown record on vinyl. Mm. And spin them really loud in the living room all the time. My mother would take us to musicals and expose us to a lot of pop music, a lot of classical music. We would go to classical concerts. But as far as the actual creation of music, you know, I took piano for a while, but neither of my parents are musical. I'm not sure I've even heard my parents sing in my whole life. My sister is a savant. Hmm. But I think that was maybe a little bit of Southern culture there too, because, you know, I wanted to be in band and my parents really discouraged that, whereas they encouraged it with my sister. I think that maybe has something to do with, you know, sort of cultural roles for you depending on the sex you are. Hmm. But when I got older, what was interesting is I was racing cars. And then when I moved to California, I thought, you know, I'm going to have an adjustment here on my cost of living. I'm going to pick up a hobby that is more affordable than racing. Little did I know. Little did I know. That was out of the frying pan into the fire, maybe. But yeah, so you can spend a lot of money on music. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was initially why I picked up the instrument, you know,
as a diversion as an alternative, a plan B to racing cars.
That's correct. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
You know what else is interesting? I interviewed a musician yesterday who's also from East Tennessee, who's a little younger than you and grew up listening to Motown. Same thing. Dad was actually a drummer. You know, not full time. He had a job, but you know, he played with a band. But all they listened to is Motown growing up, and I find that really interesting. Knowing that, you know, how segregated the South was at a certain point in time, not that long ago, and all this Motown is going on there. So that's very interesting. In of all places, East Tennessee. So it seems to me that most of the people who wind up working with things that are super detailed, like cars, like amplifiers, things that are electrical related or mechanical or engineering, we're all tinkerers in their youth. Were you a tinkerer as a kid?
That's a good question. And the truth is, I really wasn't. And I think that you're very accurate in that. observation, because a lot of the people who I work with are tinkers. My childhood was very busy. You know, I was a theater nerd. I played sports. I went to summer camp. Education was really important in my family. You know, you spend a lot of time doing your homework. And so there wasn't a lot of idle time for me to, you know, in a curious way, take something apart and then not put it back together and upset my parents because I ruined their toaster or whatever. But I'd say the only thing that I did notice, especially I noticed this when I was a mechanic or a technician, is my father had electric trains, model trains. We had a really large setup. And so whereas I think a lot of people my age, where I live, their dad might have showed them how to change the oil in their car or change a tire. You know, I was playing with my dad's voltmeter, and he was showing me basics to electricity. So while I didn't really tinker, I did get some exposure there to electronics at a young age. And I think that that really helped my career with BMW. And I think that it certainly helped with this, what I do now, as far as not as much fear of electricity.
So that was potentially the curiosity prompt that started you down the path.
Definitely, or at least opened the door to a path that involved electronics. I see that a lot in people is sort of, you know, electricity is something that you can't touch. It's something that you can only really think about and observe measurements. I mean, you can certainly touch it in an unpleasant way.
Sure.
But, you know, it's hard to visualize. And, you know, typically males are very visual thinkers. So you can think about water in a pipe or, like, you know, pistons moving in an engine or strings vibrating on a guitar. But electricity is a little bit harder to imagine how it's working and what it's doing. And so I think that certainly just made me not hesitate as much.
Yeah, you know, that is really very accurate. I've never thought that, because I don't typically do handyman stuff because I don't have the time, but I've done everything. You know, when I do have time and something needs to be done, I have no problem doing it, with one exception: electricity, because I can't see it. And it and for me, I know, therefore, if I can't see it, I'm going to get in trouble I could potentially get in trouble unless I really know what the hell I'm doing. So that's something I've always called somebody to help me with. It's really interesting and very, very on target.
The consequences are high for a mistake.
About a month ago, this is a silly little thing. The bulb on top of the oven went out. And for some reason, every time those bulbs go out, they break. You know, they're super delicate. And not realizing it, I just touched it, and, you know, of course the current was on everything, and holy shit, man, I don't get scared about stuff. You know, I've sort of been around the block, not really much scares me, like, you know, if you get injured or this and that, but that was like, my heart skipped a beat. I was like, holy
probably literally.
I was like, holy shit, I just touched, like, really just teased it, and it was like, holy crap. So I didn't learn, you know, I still haven't fixed it. I got to go back in one weekend and just turn off the circuit and deal with it then. But holy shit, you are right. The consequences are big. So let me ask you this. You start playing guitars late in your teenage years. How does this lead to, like, you working on amplifiers? Because it's really, they're kind of related, but there's no typical direct path. Not everybody that works on guitars or knows guitars works on amps, and vice versa. They're in some ways mutually exclusive at the level you're performing. How did that come about?
Well, how did I ended up where I am now? I would say, well, I mean, I've always had an interest in guitar amps specifically as a fan of music, because some of the music that meant the most to me usually involved a distorted electric guitar. Mm-hmm. And I liked the sounds that it made. And then as I would read, you know, interviews with artists and magazines who I liked, and, you know, talk to other musicians who I had a lot of friends who were good musicians, it seemed that these technology from the 60s that used these little glass tubes seemed to be a key component to it. And as a less, like, concrete answer, a little more silly. I, you know, even as a kid, I really liked Star Wars. And I remember there's a scene in Empire Strikes Back where Luke is hanging upside down in a snow cave. And he needs his lightsaber, which is in the snow below him. And he reaches for it, and he's like trying to pull the lightsaber up using the Force, which, you know, is magic. And as a kid in a rural area, I remember trying to like pull something into my hand using the Force. And I genuinely believe that the only thing keeping me from accomplishing that was my belief. It wasn't reality or physics or the fact that the Force isn't real. It was that if I just believed enough. And so I love this idea of magic. And to be perfectly honest, electricity really is the closest thing that we have to magic in the real world, because of some of the reasons you just covered. You can't see it, but it affects every aspect of our life. It makes things possible that aren't. And also, you know, music with the vibrations in there, there's so much in common with the way that air, that the sound moves through the air, and the way electrical currents work. And so for me, it's as I became an adult and realized, you know, finally the Force is not real, but there are things in the world that really are magical. The closest that I can ever become to being a wizard would involve either a music and or electricity. And so even as a mechanic, I loved music. And when I did go to engineering school, I actually changed my major from mechanical to electrical, because I felt like that would leave more options open in the future if by this Hail Mary chance, off chance, I ever got to work in the music industry. I would love to be able to build guitar amplifiers. And so I guess it's always been there. And then I just happened to be really lucky in that several years ago, an opportunity came for me to go after that, and I took it. So,
no, sorry, go ahead. I apologize.
Oh, that's it.
No, that was a great story, man. I appreciate you sharing that. I've heard similar things. I remember I had a client many years ago, and he was a physician. He was like a cardiologist, and I asked him, I said, Rick, what made you become a cardiologist? And he said, I wanted to do something that really, it was the equivalent of what you said, the physiological force, and that was the heart. And he said, because without the heart, nothing happens. So it made me think of that, because what you're saying is sort of parallel, because, you know, with this power electricity has, and it without that, nothing's going on.
Nothing.
You mentioned that you noticed that most of the guitarists you liked, we were attracted to, had the distorted sound. Who did you listen to as a kid growing up that you were turned on like that?
Well, I was pretty sheltered living in a rural area, and most music I was exposed to was, like I mentioned, Motown, a lot of musicals, a ton of classical music, and then, you know, in my mom's station wagon, we'd hear a lot of pop music. And it wasn't until I was in junior high and we got MTV finally, and I became exposed to a lot of different types of music that I really enjoyed. Initially, what I was really drawn to actually was rap music of the late 80s. And this is before Dr. Dre. And before Dr. Dre, in my opinion, rap was not as well-defined. There were all types of rap, a lot of which involved the use of instruments and more music, especially East Coast rap from New York. Some of my favorite bands in the world were part of what they call like the Native Tongue family, you know, Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, Jungle Brothers, Black Sheep.
KRS-One, stuff like that?
Yeah. And when Dr. Dre hit, it was this, you know, when The Chronic came out, it was this huge, huge cultural phenomenon. And it kind of, I feel like a lot of rap became sort of gangster rap, because before that, it was, Tupac was like the closest thing to gangster rap, maybe Gangstar, but you had The Roots, you had all these other types of rap that kind of fell by the wayside after that. And then it was when I started to hear in my younger sister's room the music that she was playing, I became more attracted to that. Bands like Stone Temple Pilots, Pearl Jam, especially Soundgarden. And it was a lot of the sounds that really interest me. You know, I think that's a thing that musicians do a really good job of, listening to the notes and the pitch and the harmonies and the melodies. And I think I'm kind of weird in the way that I listen to music, because I like the sounds. I like the tones. It'd be like going to an art gallery to appreciate the paints and not necessarily the painting.
Man, that makes a ton of sense, actually. Yeah, I think that, but that's why you're, and I apologize, I clipped you off there.
No.
That is why you do what you do, because that is awesome, man. That's phenomenal that you listen to the sounds and that you're focusing on that, because, and that's why you're, like I said, that's why you're so good at what you do as far as that goes, because you're focused on the end product, the tone, the sound. That's it, you know, and that's what an amp does. And that's cool, man. That's very cool. When you first started getting into amps, whether it was repairing and then building, what were some of the surprises, if any, that you came across? Like, was anything like, I didn't realize that, or things that the average, you know, the common guitar player, the bedroom guitar player, or even the professional wouldn't be aware of?
One of the biggest surprises to me that is, I'm still sitting here surprised by it, to be honest, is when we're talking about guitar amps, musical gear, a lot of the things that we like to talk about as musicians or fans of music are very subjective things. Oh, I really like the overdrive on my Sedano SLO versus a 1968 Marshall. But there are things about this business that are not subjective, they are objective. How electricity works, for example, is not really an opinion, okay? And a lot of the more black and white technical aspects of how, I'd say specifically like vacuum tube guitar amplifiers work, these things are not as well known or understood as I really expected them to be. Maybe that's because I was coming from the automotive world and some, at least part, engineering school experience. And so that was the single biggest surprise for me, is a lot of the more fundamentals of even just things like electricity that are not necessarily understood by a lot of people putting together these devices. I mean, to be perfectly honest, it's a lot of paint by numbers. And I don't know if this makes sense, what I'm about to say, but, you know, a lot of amps out there being made today that are clones of old Fender guitar amps. And if the layout of the circuit does not really closely match the layout of how a 60s Fender is done, I've noticed that a lot of techs have trouble recognizing that, because they're kind of more looking at the layout and not necessarily thinking about how the amp works and how the electricity is flowing through it. So that was by far, I think, the biggest surprise for me, is a lack of understanding of the more fundamental aspects of how the amp works and the things that really aren't subjective. You know, how the parts work, how they interact, how things should be grounded. And I think that that's probably, you know, my theory on partially why that is that tube technology hasn't been taught in schools since, I'm guessing, it for sure the 60s. I don't know if they were still teaching it in the 70s even. And so a lot of the people who kind of learned it from the top down are old or have retired or died off, unfortunately. And I really hope that some of this knowledge is not lost to time, because I think it's a really important thing for that everyone can benefit from, whether you're sitting at home listening to the radio and you want to hear a great song that has a great guitar sound, or you're a professional musician who needs those things in order to make a living, or anything in between.
That's really interesting. So what the fundamentals, basically, of, again, back to that magic thing, electricity, that's a lot of that seems to be lost on people, and that's why they struggle replicating the great sounds that you're able to get or you're after.
Well, that's a good question, too, because I think when you're talking about art, a lot of the times a sort of top-down approach can, in a way, be a barrier because you're thinking about how things should be. A lot of really famous guitar amps, for example, the Tweed Bassman, which is one of the most, if not the most influential guitar amp of all time, in my opinion, there are actually some errors in that schematic that Leo Fender might not have realized he did. So I think it's good to have a blend of sort of bottom-up, top-down approaches to this, especially since, you know, we're not saying toasters, we're making tools that are used to make art. Mm. But at the same time, we do need both of these. And I can take these parts, like a resistor and a capacitor, and I can put them together and see the effects. But if I don't fundamentally understand how they're working, someone can come and scramble it up a little bit, and I might be lost at that point if I don't understand, you know, how the electricity is flowing. And it's totally silly, but even if you're talking about like grounding an amp, I literally think about Luke pulling his lightsaber up, because that's how I imagine the grounds to work, which is a very bottom-up way to think about it, but with top-down too, there is a way that electrons flow, and a lot of really great amps I'll see have crazy ground schemes that have redundancies or just plain errors. And, you know, to me, this is way more fundamental than the more of the stuff that we like to talk about, you know, like, ooh, these different capacitors have different sounds, or we sit here and tweak values in the circuit or adjust things so that someone like Carlos Santana can sit there and tell you he's reached some transcendental state because of their amp, you know.
I think everything you said makes a ton of sense, and there's a ton of analogies you can draw off that. I mean, you know, I work out and I try to stay in shape, and it's like someone coming to the gym and, you know, spending 20 minutes to figure out, you know, when they're doing, you know, wrist curls, you know, which is a very incidental, as ancillary, end of the food chain exercise as you can, and most people don't even need to do it. Why that's not working when they're should be worried about, you know, why did you just come from McDonald's before you went to the gym? Yeah. So I totally get it, man. It makes a ton of sense. So the average guitar player goes in and buys an amp. What are the biggest mistakes that a guitarist would make, you know, things that they're preoccupied with that are actually irrelevant, you know, the wrist curls of the amplifier world and the things they should be focusing on instead?
That's a really hard question to answer, because that is definitely something that I deal with on a daily basis. And I've definitely learned some tools on how to help people with that from when I was a mechanic or even working with race cars, because a lot of times people say, you know, what car should I get? And you have to, what I learned from years of being a mechanic first, that definitely I think gave me a little bit of a head start in dealing with people as far as picking music gear or guitars, basses, pedals, amps, speaker cabinets, is that people are going to give you an answer. They're going to use words and they're going to say something. And you should listen to that and carefully analyze that. But then also, I should sort of read between the lines. As an example, 95% of humans, if they were to ask me as a mechanic, what kind of car should I get? My first question is going to be, how long are you going to keep it? And almost everyone will always say, oh, I'm going to keep this forever.
Forever. But
right.
It's like when you move into a house. Oh, we're going to live here forever.
We're going to live here forever. Yeah. And it didn't take me but about a half a decade to realize that I don't know what the cause is of just being a human or being part of a capitalist society where, you know, we're under pressure to buy, or we like the what goes along with having a new car and how it makes you feel and how people see you. But a lot of people actually never do that. And so I learned to try to look for other clues, is to say, you know, I know this person's telling me they're going to keep it, but do I really think they are? You know, how old's their car they have now?
Okay.
You know? And so a lot of the similar thing happens with guitar gear. So as I carefully listen to what they say, and that's really important, but then also look for other data to try and pull to make a conclusion. How old is the gear that they have now? How old is their car? Do they seem like a type of person who, you know, is going to keep things? But even more specific than that is, what is the right tool for the job? You know, if you were to say, what's better, a spoon or a fork? I would say, well, what do you have in Super Salad?
Right.
And so when a lot of people, you know, might ask me what kind of amp or what kind of gear do I need, the first thing I would say is, well, you know, tell me about how you use your gear. And right off the bat, we can separate this into two categories with the gray area in between, and that's professional musicians and non-professional musicians, right? Because the stakes are higher when you keep the lights on, you make your money from being a musician.
Of course.
And then these instruments become, they kind of fall more in the category of tools. And there's way more necessity and utility that becomes important there. You know, as a mechanic, I bought these wrenches. And at the end of the day, I could still fix the car. I could tighten the bolts. But as I progressed, I found that, you know what? I like the feel of these snap-on wrenches better. Or they're just right. But I still could get the job done with the other tools. For a working musician, he or she needs to have everything they need to do their job and to keep their job and make their money, and then maybe from there begin to cater and adjust the gear that they need and want for their taste. For everyone else, even though we don't want to admit it or we want to prepare for a career that we think we're going to have, it really is a little bit more of a luxury or a leisure activity.
Yeah, man, that makes a lot of sense. Totally.
And then, so even among the working musicians, I think that you can divide it further, is that a lot of the guys who are what I would call more of a road warrior, which is someone for hire who is out, you know, doing gigs out on the road. You're hired to go play shows. Typically, these guys are going to be hired to do, you know, songs they didn't necessarily write, that maybe someone else wrote. It could be a cover band or it could just be music of that artist. And in that case, you know, a lot of those guys are going to spend time listening to the albums, and they need to be able to in some way approximate the tones and feel of what the artist has already created. And you know, you see a lot of those guys, at least in my experience, having really quality extensive pedal boards, and maybe the amp is less of a part of the equation of what defines their tone. Because if you're flying around the country, you can't always take your amp with you. It's a lot easier to take your guitar and your pedal board. And if you kind of build your sound around always using a Hot Rod Deluxe, pretty much anywhere you go, you can count on them having a Hot Rod Deluxe that you plug into and you're familiar with. If you're an artist writing your own music or a member of a band, if you're maybe to a lesser degree, maybe more degree, if you're a session guy, you know, doing studio work, then the rules are a little different, especially a lot of the big session guys. You know, they have what's called cartage, where you have companies who essentially move all the gear around for them. And in that case, the convenience of having to load your gear in and out of a taxi cab or an Uber becomes less important. Because you just call your cartage up and say, I want this, 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 and this delivered here at this time. You don't have to worry about breaking your back. You don't have to worry about as much about how big or complicated your setup is. So I know this is probably getting further away from an answer to your question because
no, but it's answering it accurately, because the answer is it, you know, from what I'm hearing, and I've never considered that, it really depends what you know, what you're overlooking really depends on what your function of the gear is what you're saying, I think, right?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And then you combine that with sort of the human element of it that I mentioned with cars, is so we have all these things to consider. How are they going to use it? You know, what are the important factors for them, right? Is weight a big deal? Because if you have cartage, that's what the strong back, weak mind is there for, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about breaking your back. But if you're a guy doing two or three gigs around town and you've got to be able to load in and out on the side of a busy road, it's really nice to have one little combo and a guitar that you can throw in a trunk and pull out. Because, yeah, that other rig you have, it might really have that tone. But at the end of the day, if you're playing at a bar for a bunch of drunk people, they're probably not going to really notice a huge difference.
Right.
And you're going to get really tired of hauling that stuff in and out of the bar or the venue and maybe having it potentially stolen or damaged. And so we listen to what people say, but then we also look for other data that's kind of reading in between the lines. Because a lot of us are not necessarily being honest with ourselves. No, for me, it's just about the tone, right? Well, you say that now, but after 6 months of doing a gig downtown at night after you've worked all day, it's going to have an effect on whether or not you want to schlep that 1972 Marshall 212 combo that weighs 80 pounds and is really awful. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to grab the Blues Junior because you're tired, and it's just the reality of it. So
it's funny you say that, because Ann and I were in Nashville, I think, last September, and we were, you know, in the evening down on Broadway, and it was pouring one night, and I see this poor guy with a pallet, like, pushing this pallet of equipment. It was just a guitar player. He's, like, pushing this from, I'm assuming he was going from one gig to the next, and he's schlepping in this thing in the rain, and I was like, oh, my God, you know, talk about... what are the things that you don't like about being a musician? I was like, holy crap, there's got to be a better way. So it makes 100% sense exactly what you're saying. And that's a very, like, thorough and comprehensive of way of and the right way of figuring out the net result of answering. Well, it's like a almost a schematic. You know, are you doing this? Then you go down to the arrow here. Yes or no. Are you doing this? Yes or no. If so, go across to the page. But the net result of that at the very bottom, I think, will drop out different amps and different setups, whichever path the yes and no's lead you to.
Definitely. Yeah. And as a New Yorker, you probably more than any other American from any city, can appreciate what you have to deal with having to get in and out of a car at a crowded venue or street, you know, and what you have to deal with. I would say this, though. Is when it comes to picking gear in general, the number one obstacle I do see with people, and this applies to everyone, is their brain gets in the way, right? So we do need to spend a little time. We put on our tweed jacket with patches on the elbows, and we've got our pipe, and we're sitting in a leather chair, and we're rubbing our chin, and we're thinking, we're deducing. And we're trying to be objective about what we need. But because of the nature of music, I think that's really, really important. And this is the single most thing that applies to all the categories of people, is that at some point we need to take off our thinking cap, take off our tweed jacket, and put on our work boots, and kind of be a big dumb dummy and just go out there and basically be a gear slut. Mm. And we need to turn our brain off. We should experience as many different amps and as guitars as we can. You know, ideally, I think it would be cool if you could sit down at a music store and have a friend blindfold you and just hand you random guitars.
Oh, yeah.
And you never know what's going to speak to you. Something is going to, if you're lucky enough to find that piece of gear that really inspires you. You know, the goal, in my opinion, is to lose time. We pick up an instrument, we plug it into an amp or whatever, and we start playing. And the next thing we know, it's been 45 minutes to an hour, and it doesn't even feel like it.
Yeah,
right? That's the secret ingredient. And if you're lucky enough to find one of those pieces of gear in your travels, don't let your brain block you from it. Well, you know, in my head, I really thought I needed a Les Paul and a Marshall with channel switching. Well, you know, maybe this Strat and this... Reason combo are what really gets you there. And so definitely there's a time to turn off our brain and turn on our heart. And then there is a time when, like, for the guy schlepping that gear down Broadway in Nashville that you saw, you know, for him, there is a time to turn on our brain too. But I do, unfortunately, I will occasionally see artists who will bring something to me that really is special. In just the individual amp, there's something about it that all the, you know, the lines crossed and hit right where they need to be, the stars lined up, and it just has this sound that really sucks you in. But in their minds, maybe it's like, well, I really thought I needed this, and then they let it go. And these are the things that when you're older, you're thinking back and you're like, man, I never should have let that go.
Right.
You know? So that's definitely the biggest thing, is don't let things slip through your fingers, because it's not what you had deduced or objectively decided that you need. If you are lucky enough to find one of those pieces of gear that really inspires you and motivates you, and it's something that you can afford and is reasonable to use, keep it and grab it and hold it closely and don't let it get away from you, even if it's not what you think you need.
That's a great answer. It's almost like, I know I often equate finding guitars and I've never thought about amps, but it's the same, because I haven't done what you're saying. I haven't sat down and played all the amps. But I often equate finding guitars to like finding a mate.
You know? Exactly.
It's got to fit you.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to just feel right. It's got to, you know, you got to have that chemistry with it. It's not to make it work and to be rewarding as truly as it could be.
You might think you need a blonde accountant from Nantucket, but you meet this, you know, brunette
you need a spicy Latina.
Right. I mean, if you meet someone
from Santa Cruz,
if they make you happy and it's the perfect person for you, don't push them aside, because it's like, in my mind, I think I need to be with this other type of person. Perfect example, Craig Corbin.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just about, I think a lot of this has to do with allowing, you know, listening to the universe in a sense. In my opinion, that's harder to do when you're younger. And you have to get to a point in your life where you're okay with that, where, you know, because it's a lot less, for me anyway, it's been a lot less stressful when I've done that. But minimizing stress wasn't a valuable skill set or tool until I became older. And then I'm like, why the fuck do I want to have stress? You know, let me just, like, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't think that you can kind of get that, unfortunately, when you're younger. I mean, some people do, and I've spoken to some actually musicians, and I get off the phone with them like, holy shit, this guy's really got it together. And I didn't have it together until many, many years after that. But yeah, I think a lot of it's just like listening to the universe or your environment or whatever you want to call it. You mentioned, John, that sometimes you'll see musicians come in with an amp that's just like, wow, why are you messing with this, or why don't you want it? Have you seen, is there an amp that sticks out as one of those amps that you see on a frequent basis that every time it's presented itself to you, you say that to yourself?
Well, there's definitely, I think that when we're looking at guitars, basses, I just want a pedal guy, but with amps, definitely. How do I put this? Like, you can think about the individual thing that's sitting there. And so occasionally an amp will come my way, and it really is something special. It's one of those amps where, like what I was saying, is you plug in and you're like, boo, and you realize you've spent 45 minutes playing it and it didn't even feel like anything. And you never know where you're going to find one of those things. Right, it could be a Line 6 Spider, which everyone likes to make fun of, or it could be a 1962 Marshall that was made in, you know, Mr. Marshall's kitchen. You never really know, and so I think we should always be open-minded. Yeah, I know this is a piece of crap Yamaha pink guitar, but man, it sounds incredible. And so when special things come my way, sometimes it's just this individual amp. So I have like my list of five favorite amps that are the actual individual amps, and I can tell you the person who owns it and the year it was and everything that's about it. But in a more general sense, if you're saying like, well, hey, you know, this certain model that comes into my shop, I might not have heard this one, but of the couple dozen I've heard of this, they all seem to be really good. So I guess to answer that, if you mean like as far as a make and model, it sounds kind of cheesy, but I've come to really appreciate a lot of the reissue Fenders. You know, obviously the Blackface reissues are really popular, but they have a new line that's the, and I don't work for Fender, by the way, I realize what I sound like, the Drip Edge reissue. I think it's called like the 68 Custom. Those, you know, some of them sound better than others, but they all sound pretty good. And even the Hot Rod series, the Hot Rod Deluxe, Hot Rod DeVille, Blues Deluxe, Blues DeVille, not the distortion channel, but the clean side of that is consistently a pretty decent clean platform for anything. So as far as like makes and models, there definitely are lines out there that I know I can count on to be in this ballpark range of a certain quality that I appreciate. But if you're talking about specific amps, I can tell you by far one of the amps that is burned into my memory was a Tweed Twin. And this Tweed Twin is owned by a man named Gordon Kennedy, who is a fantastic musician here in Nashville. He plays for Garth Brooks and Eric Clapton. And at the time, I worked for my amp sensei, Kai Kennedy. And I will never forget the lesson that I learned this day, because Gordon is there and Kai is there, and I'm Kai's apprentice. And Kai is an amazing guitar player in his own right, but we're in his shop where there are these bookshelves and there's all this stuff. And when he cranks an amp, you know, things will rattle and shake, right? Different things. Right. But he has this Tweed Twin, and even he's excited about this. You know, old master doesn't get excited about anything, but the Tweed Twin, he's even excited about that. And so he's got his shooter's muffs on, his hearing protection, and he pulls it aside, and he looks at me, and he's like, use your eyes to see how much tone this amp has. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, look around. Everything in this room is shaking. The amp has so many harmonics that is hitting the resonant frequency of all these different things. Whereas normally, like, one amp might make the bottle shake on the shelf, or this might do that. And so he puts his earphones or his hearing protection on, we all do, and starts playing, and everything in the room is shaking. And it's definitely an amp where the sound is in your head. It's something you're feeling and experiencing. And so not only was that specific amp one of the most incredible sounding amps I've ever heard, but I learned a cool lesson there about, while tone is definitely a subjective thing, there are objective aspects to it. As far as how much tone does something have? Does it have a lot of harmonics? And so that is kind of cool. It was a cool lesson for me. Interestingly, that amp, now, you hear all these stories, you don't know if they're true or not, but supposedly Keith Richards has a ton of Tweed Twin amps in consecutive serial numbers, and this is one of the next ones he needs. And the story that I was told is that he has offered Gordon Kennedy a lot of money for this amp on multiple occasions, sometimes way more than they go for, just because he wants that next one, and Gordon's like, nope, not going to sell it. Pretty cool little.
And this is an original Fender Tweed, like back from the 60s?
Yeah. Yes, this will be, I guess, a 59 Tweed high-power twin, and just an amazing amp.
I'll tell you what also lesson that shows you the intensity of the collector's mentality. You know, Keith Richards needs another amp like you and I need another hole in the head, right? No, seriously. Yeah. But is why when you issue things and you make them collectible, they are always valued more. Maybe not immediately, but, right. You know, I've done a lot of business and publishing over the years in various product, and oftentimes we'd set up a limited issue for a product or something because of that mystique. It always drives value. It's really interesting because people are very it's almost like a fetish. That, you know, there are people that are collectors of stuff, ridiculous right. shit. In some occasions, but it's just collector's mentality. Really interesting. Is there an amp out there that, if you're comfortable saying that, is that you consistently hear and it's always touted as, you know, as something, and you like see it and it's either like sounds like crap, or you question why, or it's always in for repairs, and just like, you know, you have no idea how it got that publicity. Like a very
yeah, definitely. I mean, and like I said, you know, you have to take each device on an individual basis. Now, granted, certain product lines or models, you're more likely to get one of those good special things. And this is kind of funny, but Dumble, you know, yeah. I've had the opportunity to experience two Dumbles, at least here recently. And one of them really was incredible. It was something else. It was amazing. But then there was another Dumble that I played. I think the one that was amazing, I think actually, I might be getting this mixed up with who bought which one, but I think Eric Clapton bought that one. It was a combo. And then I also, playing a 58 Les Paul, this is the Grunes guitars, not that long ago, I got to play a Dumble. It was the head and cabinet, so it was the combo version. And I even had this fantastic guitar to play it with, and it was just honestly, it was just garbage. It was one of the most numb, stale, stiff, bland amps I've ever heard. Now, to be fair though, this amp had lived a collector's life, so the tubes in it were still original from 1992, signed by Dumble, because he didn't want to change them because they were signed.
Okay.
But you know, a working musician, I think that Joe Bonamassa ended up buying this amp. I'm sure that he went through and had it brought back to life, you know, serviced and made healthy again.
Gotcha.
But yeah, you never know where you're going to find something great and something terrible. And sometimes it's in the things that you're really surprised to find out are not that great. You know, like maybe a classic Strat, and you plug it in and it just sounds like, it's a surprising thing, but it does happen occasionally.
And just so for some people listening that don't know Dumble, those are handmade amps, I think, out of California, and some pretty famous people have used them. I mean, they're literally cranked out one at a time, like on spec, no?
That's correct. Yeah. And he is a very, I guess you could call him Alexander or Howard, I'm not sure what he would prefer, but Mr. Dumble is a very eccentric, introverted person. And he is fantastically talented and meticulous, and almost to the point of being like a mad scientist in the mad scientist way, not in the, you know, he's definitely, I would say, at the top of the pyramid for famous amp builders, especially ones that are still alive. And people pay thousands and thousands of dollars for his amp. Sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars. One of the amps that I was just talking about sold for over $100,000 for a guitar amplifier. Wow. It's crazy.
Yeah, that is really crazy, because, yeah, you know, I mean, that's just, that's crazy.
it's so much money. I just can't imagine for anything that you can't live in.
Hey, you probably worked on some 7 Series BMWs, or that would cost more than that.
But not even that much. I mean, I think, you know, rarely was there a BMW that cost more than $100,000 until the past 5 years. So even then, you know, I don't know. It's a lot of money to spend on a guitar amp. And, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting about Dumble is everyone spends so much time obsessing about what his secret is. And I just like to talk about Dumble because I think that the secret to Dumble and some of the incredible Dumble clones that I've played, there's one of the friend of mine, a customer I was talking to just a couple hours ago, he has a really early Two Rock, which Two Rock is a company that clones Dumbles very meticulously. And the secret is that there is no secret. It's heartbreaking, but it's the truth. It's the same with Eddie Van Halen. Everyone's like, well, what guitar do you use? What amp do you use? Those are important. There's no denying that. But the secret is heartbreaking because the truth is it's him. It's his ability. It's his, the hours and hours of dedication that he spent becoming a good player and learning to open his mind to go places that he wouldn't have gone before. And with Dumble, yeah, it might be this certain capacitor or resistor or tube that he used, but in reality, when you look inside, it's just craftsmanship and skill and a lot of experience. And there's no shortcut for that. And that kind of sucks to hear because you want to be able to go buy something or do something to find a short path there. But man, there's no such thing as a free lunch, I don't think.
No, it's reps. Reps and time.
It's reps.
Time under tension or whatever the hell you're doing. It's just time, you know. Let's talk about Black Tape, your amps, your amp line. Who are your primary customers and what makes Black Tape amps a little different from other amps? What is your mojo that you've put in that gives it its oomph?
Well, I'd say that for Black Tape, a lot of our amps right now are custom. I would say the majority of our amps are custom built specifically for a musician. And so the exact nature of Black Tape is still somewhat nebulous because it tends to adapt to whoever comes to me and says, hey, you know, I'd like an amp and this is what I'd like. I will say that there's a process to making a Black Tape amp that is very important to me. And that is, when you're talking about sounds and tones, it's really hard when two humans are communicating to describe sounds with language.
Yeah.
It's really difficult. And so someone might say, you know, I want this sound, I want this feel. Well, when I had the privilege of being a race car mechanic in California, I got to observe some really good race car engineers. And anyone who builds things or is technical, it's true, you're more likely to put too much emphasis in the technology or the physical things that you're making and devoting your life to and studying and building. When in fact, it's really a big part of it is the musician, or in the case of my example, a race car driver. And so the approach that I saw really good engineers have, specifically Carol Smith, who is one of my heroes, the father of modern race car engineering, and I went to his lecture where he specifically said this, is he said, the best thing you can do to be the best engineer and make the best car you can is to carefully listen to your driver and learn to communicate with them. And you have to build a vocabulary. And so almost every Black Tape amp, we spend a lot of time what I call tone tuning and or fine tuning. And so if someone comes in and we have an amp there and they might say, oh, I want it to be woolly or fuzzy or crunchy or stiff or soft or loose. And these are words that literally don't apply to sounds. So as a way for us to build a language with each other is they can bring all their gear and we set everything up and I'm there at my workbench with the amp, you know, opened up, and we can start to change things, swap out parts and change aspects of the amp. And then really it's important to communicate, well, did you hear anything change, is what I'll say to the artist. And then they'll say, well, you know, and then they'll give me a word. Oh yeah, that got a little more woofy, or that got a little more biting, or that got a little more cutting. And so I can try to learn to assign the words that the two of us are using to that particular amp and what they mean by that. And so in a sense, I'd like to be adaptive. Like Bruce Lee said, be like water, you know, always take the shape of your container, be ready to adapt to any circumstance. And so I would rather not bring a certain formula, but rather find a way to be a chauffeur. And I'll take you wherever I can, but at the end of the day, you guys tell me, you know, turn left, turn right here, and I'll make sure it happens. But sometimes it's only a couple hours, and sometimes it might take several sessions of us spending time, of changing aspects of the amp, and then them saying, yeah, that word, that's, this is what I mean by that, or I need more of that or less of that. And then another interesting aspect that is also challenging for the musician is, you know, when people hear about this process, they get excited. What I think people don't realize is how much work it is for the musician too, is what, how that sound in my shop, how does that translate to when you're in battle, when you're there on stage with the drummer and there's a bass player or guitar player or pedal steel player. And it takes, for maybe younger, newer artists, it doesn't take long, but it takes a little while to figure out how that translates to what I'm hearing in the shop and how that's going to end up on the track, on the microphone, or, you know, on stage in the mix. And so those two things we work together is I try to build a channel of communication with the artist so they can help me get them where they need to go. And then also they need to learn where it is they need to go, because how the sound that they're hearing there is going to end up in the final product is really important too. So it's a learning experience for both of us. But to answer your question, I would like to be as adaptive as possible. And I feel like this approach is the best way to do that. And so one black tape might be bassy and stiff, and another one might be more trebly and reactive. And at the end of the day, that hopefully is just what that particular artist wanted from that amp. And, you know, as we expand and have actual product lines, we're cranking out, you know, hopefully dozens of an amp at a time, you know, then I might be more interested in sort of solidifying an identity for Black Tape. But right now, because it's mostly just custom builds for individuals, it is really a nebulous definition of what makes a Black Tape, other than I really want it to be reliable. Because of all the tones you can have, the sound of silence, that is the worst sound. And that is a tone that every audience can tell. They might not be able to tell whether you're using nickel-plated steel strings or steel strings, but they sure as heck can tell if your amp's not working. And if you're working for someone, the boss can tell too, and that does not help your employment chances in the future. So I'd say that's definitely priority one.
Wow, that's super. And everything, you know, I have this expression, how you do one thing is how you do everything. And you're very, very thorough and consistent with that, because ultimately, you know, philosophically, everything with you comes down to that electricity and what is the sound. It, you know, you're a true, like, sound purist to the point where, and I think that's a very intelligent move. You got to figure out how people communicate, because somebody might call it woofy. I may call it warm. Another guy may call it, you know, feel good. And that's really perceptive that you, I mean, you're like a very perceptive person to back, you know, sort of like reverse engineer the process to, okay, let's figure out what, you know, let's get our definitions on the same, let's communicate, let's speak the same language, because that's what this is about. And if we're not speaking the same language, you know, you could tell me you want it bright and tingly, but that doesn't mean anything, because my perception of bright and tingly is, you know, spanky. You know, it's
right.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, man. What's the most important thing you've learned from the very first amp you built or modded to today, both about building the amps and about what guitarists want and they're willing to pay for?
Oh, wow. I don't think I have learned much there.
Is that because the guitars can't make up their mind?
You know, I really am not sure. One thing I have learned, if I understand your question correctly, is that probably if I think something's really cool or a good idea, it's probably not. You know, I mean, that sounds silly, but for a minute I was a dealer for Framus guitars, and I really liked the natural finishes, you know, where you see the wood, because to me it's a piece of wood. I like I like that. As it turns out, most people don't want a natural finish guitar. They right. want some kind of paint. Is that kind of what you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, I guess the first time you modded a guitar to today, like, what's the, and maybe you answered it with the last question. I guess my question is, what's the big leap in experience? What's the most important lesson? But it might be in the last answer you gave, which is, I need to build a language that we're speaking the same thing, that we're speaking, you know, the same words mean the same thing, so they can I can therefore adapt to that. So I don't know. That might be the answer.
Well, I would say in that case, if I understand what you're saying, the thing that I learn every day, I learned it a little bit yesterday and I'll probably learn it more tomorrow, is a little sad because I want to think that what I do is really important. But every amp I work on and every, be it amateur or professional musician I work with, the truth is that the gear is certainly important, but it's really not as big a part of the equation as I thought it was and or I wanted it to be. And it's really about, you know, this sort of hard to define special thing of it's about a musician not only playing well, but coming up with interesting music that people want to hear and that they can perform it well. And so the importance of me and my role is constantly becoming lower and less important. And that's, even though I expected to learn that, I'm still surprised to learn it every day. And it is hard for my ego because I want to be, you know, the keystone of the equation. I'm not at all. I'm actually pretty low on the chain. So that's definitely the thing I've learned the most every day is it's really about the musician and their ability to do whatever it is they need to do to make it happen.
I totally get what you're saying. I think that being said, if you pull you out of the equation, the output of what they're doing with their talents and gifts will not be the same.
Well, hopefully, I'd like to be, as Pat Buchanan said to me once, be a good tone chaperone.
Be a good tone chaperone. You want a hug. Right. John, it sounds like you need a hug after you. We need to get you a hug.
It's okay. I like reality, even though it hurts a little bit. But yeah, as a support role, here's an example of, I guess, what I'm saying is, when I was a mechanic and I went from Honda to BMW, we had obviously BMW is a luxury vehicle, and so we had a different type of customer base. And it took me a couple of years to figure this out, but some people would just bring their car back all the time. It's like, ooh, rattles, and oh, there's this or that, and sometimes you can't, it hiccups at a red light every now and then when the moon is half full and yada yada, and you, after a while, you realize that maybe what they're coming here and paying me for is not necessarily to tighten this bolt or this wrench, but to give them attention and care and concern and make them feel at ease.
Oh.
And so with the musician, so not to minimize, like, I feel like what you're saying is really more important, but it's not maybe the final value of the resistor or the transformer model I put in, but rather that I spent time with them and took them seriously and listened to them. And we may have, I mean, I don't want to get into who and what it was, but just this week, I have spent an incredibly enjoyed the couple of years I've spent with one of the most incredible guitar players, in my opinion, who's alive right now.
Hey, John, for some reason it's breaking up. I don't know if it's – are you away from the mic or
– My light's just dimmed in my house. I don't know if that has anything to do with it.
Okay.
And I heard the fan in the room shut off, so maybe that's it. I'm not sure.
No, right now it's back, so you're cool. Thank you. Okay. Sorry, okay. Man, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just was really important.
No,
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of a relevant story, but there's a really great guitar player who we ended up bringing his amp back to square one. We ended up putting all the values back to where they were when he originally brought it to me a couple years ago. And we've spent all of this time trying different values and speakers and parts and things. And it's always sounded good. And I think that at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. The point is, he got to try these different things and find out what they meant. And it helped him get where he needed to be at that time to do what he needed to do his job and make the great music he makes. So I do feel like it's not that I'm not important as a support role, but the actual specifics of what I do aren't actually as important as I would like them to be. I guess I'm really not being clear. Maybe I, in fact, don't understand what I'm trying to say, and I need to figure it out so that I can be clearer. But
no, I think that's the, hey man, that's a bold, you know, admission. Not admission, because like admission isn't you did something wrong, but that's a bold statement, and I think it's fair enough, and I respect that. You know, I just think from the guitarist point, I think much of what people do in a consulting capacity is give people permission to do something else or to be something else or to use something else.
Huh. Yeah. Okay.
And I know that that's been like that with myself as in consulting in a marketing capacity with people for the last 18 years. Much of it is, you know, it's okay to do this or it's okay to be this or sell this or do this way or run this ad or have this business. And sometimes I think people just need permission. Everybody, I'm not saying I'm above that at all. I think sometimes, you know, we need permission to be or to do something and to get validated a little bit. And I think that that's okay. I don't think it implies a weakness or, I mean, life's tough. And sometimes you do need, you know, another opinion to just sort of validate something.
It is very interesting.
You know,
I like that. Yeah.
Okay, so we're taking a lot of time, and I appreciate it. Let me just ask you, I want to take you into the inside the music studio now and ask you some personal questions.
Okay.
You single or married?
I'm married.
Kids?
I don't have kids. I have three amazing dogs, but I don't have any kids.
Hey, and they will have far less stress on you than kids. Having had kids, dogs, and cats, I can tell you from experience, okay. My dogs never gave me the stress my kids gave me. How long have you been married? Long time or recent?
About 8 years.
Oh, good for you, man. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You a rule breaker or a rule follower?
I always question authority, but I will question the rule as I follow it till the end until I understand it. So I know it's really important to me. I think it's patriotic to object. I think it's being pious in religion to question. I think that's helps strengthen your faith or your belief mm-hmm. in whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
So I believe in the rules. I think they're there for a reason. I think that they usually make things better and that people who are older and wiser and gone learn those lessons the hard way. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be constantly questioning. Think for yourself, question authority. Timothy Leary said that. I think that's words to live by. But certainly respect authority.
I totally agree with you. Any hobbies or interests outside of cars and amplifiers and electricity? And Star,
you know,
and
right
Star
now,
Wars?
Yeah, I love the Star Wars. Not much. You know, honestly, right now my life is very sort of an inch wide and a mile deep, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
So I spend a lot of time, as boring as it sounds, you know, looking at schematics and drawing schematics for fun when I get home. I have friends who are artists and they like to draw as a stress relief. I like to draw or copy schematics or try to understand weird old schematics I might find. I'm not a very interesting person, unfortunately.
there's plenty of people that do 20 different things, and that doesn't make interesting. I don't believe me. What's a favorite part of what you do, and the least favorite part of what you do?
One of the things that I absolutely love is sometimes you'll have these moments. you know, most of us will think back to things that happened in our life and we're like, wow, that was special. And I'm lucky enough that sometimes in the moment I can realize it's happening and appreciate it. And there will be times in my shop when there will be these different musicians or artists or technicians who will all be there at once and will be having these incredible conversations, not even necessarily about music. People who have just got back from a world tour, or someone who just did a neck reset on a 1928 Martin. And, you know, in my shop space, I'm a tenant of a guy, Aaron, who has a hot rod shop. And so there are these hot rod customer, you know, high performance vehicles coming in. And so you have this weird mix of people from all different walks of life. And that is really exciting to me, the conversations and experiences that happen in my shop that aren't even necessarily related to the gear, but just people sharing experiences with each other. And a lot of my customers are a lot younger. I love hearing, you know, I love hearing about the world from a perspective of the younger generation. And you never know what's going to happen each day and the things that are going to come up and the things you're going to learn, the things you're going to talk about. Really exciting. And I appreciate it every moment that it happens. I love that. I also like making things. There's something that's really rewarding about putting something together with your hands. And then it lights up when you plug it into the wall. Or you can go out and drive it real fast. Anything. I think there's a really base level reward that is really hard to describe from creating something out of parts. It's a really cool thing.
One thing I really enjoy about you is you seem to be someone that's very present in the moment. And that is a, in my opinion, skill set and a really honorable, it speaks to like genuine purity of character, I guess, is, you know, without sounding very over, trying to sound over dramatic, but I think it speaks to purity of character, and I think that's a real good trait, you know, someone who's present.
Correct, thank you.
I mean, you seem like you're right there, like, you know, you give things your proper attention, and, you know, it, things mean stuff to you, and if you know, you're not the guy to, you know, talk to somebody, but your mind's thinking about, you know, holy shit, you know, I got a lot of work to do. How am I going to get through this conversation? I mean, you're more apt to say, hey, listen, this isn't a really good time. Can we talk about this later? Or whatever, which is very cool. Two more questions. If heaven exists, what do you want to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
Oh, man. Let's see. You know, I've actually been asked this question before, and I heard someone else have the most hilarious answer, and now I can't think of it because I'm nervous. You know, I would like probably more than anything else is him to say, you know, even if it was just one tiny little thing, is you helped make the world at least a little better. You know, that's what I want. I see a future that is optimistic for humans. I want us to be working together to accomplish great things, to beat disease and poverty and hunger and live on other planets and succeed and be happy. You know, happy is the new rich, is what I believe. And that's the future I want. I don't want a Mad Max dystopian Walking Dead future. And if I can in any way, even if it's just by spreading an idea, or if it's by helping a musician make a song that makes people happier and more successful, that is what I really want. More than anything, if God can say, you know, you put a Band-Aid on that kid's knee and that was enough to somehow, through the course of chain of events of making the world better, that would be really a great thing for me.
That's awesome, man. Last question. Who's had the biggest influence on your life?
Wow. I would say definitely Roland Clarkson, who was a priest when I was young. Even though I'm really not a real religious person, he definitely had a huge effect on my life and the type of person that I want to be, whether or not I succeed at that. I miss Father Roland Clarkson all the time. He was a great man.
Thanks for answering that. Hey, man, I cannot thank you enough for your sincerity, your integrity, and your time. Where can people find you online? And I know someone listening to this is going to want to, you know, get with you and sit down and go through the process of AMPS just to listen to your wisdom. It would be worth it to pay for that. Forget about the AMP. What's the best way to find you? I know you're like sort of you're on the down low a little bit, but where can people find Black Tape Amplifiers and Magnetic Flux Music?
Honestly, right now, you know, we are trying to stay kind of, what would you say, like low profile, because mm-hmm. we want to make sure to be able to build every amp with as much time as it takes to do it right. And right now we're pretty busy, you know? You know, there's a famous story about Vox amps and the way they, success defeated Vox. If you want to go read about the company that is Vox, because the Beatles kind of killed Vox by making them the most popular amp. Yeah, and not that that's happening, boy, I wish it was. But I do enjoy the low profile, and because I would rather tell you no than tell you yes and not deliver. But the best way to find us is right now it's probably on Instagram with Black Tape Amplifiers or Magnetic Flux Music. And through there you can email me and I'll answer you as soon as I possibly can. It's right now it's just Joel and I. Joel is 50% of the operation. He's a really talented technician, guitar tech and amp tech and musician. And so just the two of us, we like to go slow and be thorough. You know, we can't really bear too much of a load at the moment, but hopefully in time we'll learn how to expand that and be able to help more people if they want it. I hope that people do want, you know, some kind of help from us.
That's right. So go to Instagram. You can find Black Tape Amplifiers and Magnetic Flux Music on there. John Capito, you're the best, man. I'm really happy that you and I got to meet. I'm happy you're in my world now, and I really appreciate your time and everything you gave on this call. So thank you so much.
Craig, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
I want to thank everybody for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks so much to John Capito again for spending his time with us. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks very much for listening. You can sign up to get notified of future episodes on our website at everyonelovesguitar.com. Now go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, I'm out. Peace. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.